Mostly Awesome, a podcast about the wins and fails of innovators, brought to you by CDTM in Munich.
Hi, we are pumped to welcome Professor Diepel to our show Mostly Awesome today. He has been a professor for electrical and computer engineering at the Technical University of Munich, in short TUM, for almost 20 years now. And besides that, he's also one of our board professors at CDTM, being involved in major strategic and organizational decisions about our add-on study program in technology management, and above that, being a great mentor. Yeah, who are we? Next to me is Izzy from class of Spring 20, and I'm Ellie from class of Fall 19. We're both active students of CDTM, the add-on interdisciplinary study program in technology management from Munich.
And with Professor Diepel, we are curious to dive into his path into becoming a professor at TUM, his opinion on peer reviews, and I'd say my personal favorite, how he initiated a series called Technically Single, available on MaxDome and SIX to increase popularity of STEM field-related education and occupations, and yeah, his underlying motivation. So without further ado, let's welcome Professor Diepel to Mostly Awesome.
Professor Diepel, a very warm welcome to Mostly Awesome. So you have been a professor for data processing at the Technical University of Munich for almost 20 years now. And I'd say you don't really have this classical CV of a professor, because after your PhD, you gained industry experience for around 10 years as CTO in various tech companies. And then you only decided to go back to academia and become a professor. So what inspired you to make this decision back then to become a professor?
Yes, I'm glad to be a part of this podcast. So first of all, I would say, it seems nowadays as this, if this kind of is an unusual professor career, but back in the days, it was like the common thing for a professor in electrical engineering to have spent some time in industry first. Typically, it was expected to be somewhere between at least five years in industry before returning back to academia. So it is now, let's say, in the last 10 to 15 years, this has been kind of shrinking, this approach, and we have more and more the situation of a, let's say, more Anglo-American academic career, or as is also commonplace in other scientific fields. In engineering, it has always been like going to industry first and then come back to academia.
Ah, okay, I see. And yeah, how is it holding a chair at such a renowned university for almost 20 years now? Are you still assessed by your publishing performance, like the number of papers you publish in high-ranking journals per year, or how does it look like?
Well, let's see. When I joined the TUM about 19 years ago, I was already tenured from the very first day. Otherwise, I would not have taken the job, by the way. So my professional development as a professor and all the rights and things have not been depending on my publication record. My reputation has been depending on those things. But the reputation is, of course, a different thing. That means for a professional progress in my domain, it has not been of importance, and it is not important right now. For building up a reputation in a particular field, it has been important and it still is important. It depends a bit also on your own or on my own, value system, how important I think publications are. And I certainly think that today's approach on handling publication indices like a Hirsch index and things like this has turned out to be a little bit crazy by now, I would say. So I'm basically trying not to think about it. It's not a criteria. It happens in the end. Or it does not happen, but I don't spend any time on thinking about it. And it's certainly not a dimension that I use for making decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of handling publications, the peer review process of assessing a manuscript before it's being published is also intensely debated currently, raising, for example, the issue of lack of accountability or the possibility of abuse, along with other flaws. So I'm curious, what is your take on the peer review process?
Well, certainly peer review has its problems. I think over the last 15 to 20 years, I can see the problems have been increasing. There are two different situations. One is the situation when you are publishing. So that means you are reporting as an author about scientific work and the results that you have accomplished. And then this is where experts will be reading through your manuscripts and making decisions and evaluating your work. That is one thing. And there is certainly something that needs to be improved. And there's a lot of debate going on. I personally also think that we should probably have a more open process for reviewing. That means not that the author is public or that the reviewers are kept secret. I think the reviewers and the publishing scientists should be openly discussed with each other, so knowing each other, and everybody else can join and observe the discussion as it is going on. I think that would be an important step if it comes to reviewing publishing work. The other part of reviewing is the for research grants. So if I'm submitting a proposal for research money and it needs to be reviewed, and that process is definitely flawed by now, simply because the number of proposals that are submitted to any type of program is increasing as crazy, because it's also an effect of turning science more economic. That competition is supposed to be better, so more people are applying for smaller grants. That means I think that all this research grant proposal reviewing process has turned out to be a complete gamble. It's a lottery. So, and there I'm pretty known by now, I think, in our domain to be an advocate that we should make it a lottery to begin with, because it saves a lot of time and it has a lot of positive side effects, and we should venture into a lottery-based distribution of research money. And some organizations are actually making some experiments with this right now.
I also heard that another commonly raised issue is the dependency on the existing incentive schemes that then center research topics rather around trend topics that are high in media popularity and public attention due to the likelihood of getting a grant or further incentives. Is that still an issue in research?
Yeah, it certainly is one thing, because you mentioned earlier, okay, if you look at the typical incentive schemes that are used for measuring the performance of professors and scientists in general. So it's about how much money you earn by submitting research grants, how much you are published, and how many citations you collect and things like this. And all those things are pushing into the situation that people have to optimize how much effort and time they're spending on one or the other thing. And in the end of the day, the danger is that people are not driven primarily by their scientific interests and curiosity, but mostly how to optimize certain evaluation criteria. And it has all sorts of negative side effects. And I personally think it's not leading us into the right direction, even though it's high competitive, but competition in the strict sense of the word as it is used in economics or in business is not maybe 100% applicable to the scientific world.
And now heading over to a topic, I hope we will see some advancement even faster than in ethics and AI, namely gender inequalities in the STEM field. You have been serving as the vice president for diversity and talent management at TUM for a couple of years, and you are still active in this field. So how do you think we can make STEM fields more attractive to women?
Well, there's one challenge to see how to make it more attractive for women. I would put it in a slightly more general context and say, how can we make STEM fields more attractive for young people in general? And that also includes, of course, women. And we can also see that just because some STEM field, electrical engineering or any other informatics, is a geeky field, is not a sufficient argument to convince young people to dedicate their life to this profession and to learn it and to study it. And it has all these negative connotations, be difficult and people fail and all those things. I think we have to start out to understand and to communicate that if we are facing issues in our lifetimes on this world, it could be corona as well as challenges of climate change and how to save the climate and those things. So we also may have other types of of health issues and problems of fighting cancer. And well, you just name all those problems that we are struggling with. Where do we get the energy from in order to continue living on this earth without killing it? All those things and all the technologies and stuff that we need to solve those issues are coming from people who are basically have an educational background in STEM. And so we have to communicate more clearly. So if you really want to save the world, then the best way you can start out with is maybe get some background in the technical field, because the solutions will be coming to some extent from technology. So it's not just being a geek somehow and improving only the crispness of the images on a screen. But probably we have to refocus and say, what else can we do to contribute to saving our planet and to save our lives and save our world? That is, I think, giving it more meaning than just having the geek pictures in front and the stereotypes. We have been looking into this for some time, and now also had a supervised the thesis work on this one. I guess my hunch is that the broader public has a wrong image in their head if it comes to technical fields like electrical engineering or computer science or anything in this direction. And those pictures are old-fashioned. And also the roles that are associated with those professions are old-fashioned. So we have to change this and make sure people understand this is a contribution to saving our planet. Mm-hmm.
So you would argue that it is rather a reputational problem that all STEM study programs have.
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, if you were to say, okay, there's some stereotypes that say, okay, men are more capable for math and physics than women, that's crap. That's wrong. There's no indication in any ways that women are less capable in mathematics or physics or any similar field than men. Simply not true. There's a number of other stereotypes that go along. And then there's an interesting observation that somebody has been making some time ago. We can measure the so-called gender gap, the discrimination gap between men and women. There's some methodologies available for this. That means that you can measure how equal the men and women are in a certain society. Societies with a high value in this domain are typically in the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, European countries are doing fairly well. Countries where this type of index is very low, it's typically in Maghreb, North Africa, Turkey, Pakistan, India, in those countries. That's just a different cultural environment. But if you look into the number of young people joining STEM fields, then we see that the highest part of women in engineering fields are in those countries where they have a large gap in gender equality. So the more equal the genders are, the less the percentage of females in STEM fields. And that's kind of counterintuitive in the first moment. But the point is to see. That means in a society where women and men are close to be equal, women feel more free to choose the professions and the field of studies they feel comfortable with, they can associate with. And they rather pick something there where they see a meaning. And they don't see necessarily the meaning in electrical engineering or mechanical engineering. This is why they choose maybe law or medicine or business for that matter. In countries like in India or in Pakistan, for many women, joining an engineering field is their chance to get a decent social recognition. It's a step-up mechanism. And therefore, a lot more young women are taking those STEM fields than in our environment. So this is it's just a thing about reputation, how things are positioned. And you said, I'm still active in this one. Yes, I'm active and I keep being active in this one. And my hunch is that to say, we can't convince people to think differently by giving them all sorts of lectures and educational programs, how important electrical engineering is and how good are the job security in engineering. Young people don't care for those things. They want to be cool. They want to be part of something important. You have to convey the message, if you really want to be cool, if you really want to help us join saving the world, you better spend your time in engineering, just to make it simple statement. How do you convey this message? I think we have to make more use of media, movies, television shows, and things like this. So you hardly ever see an electrical engineer saving the world on a television show in the evening. It's all usually lawyers or medical doctors. So we should have a television show where engineers are saving the world, female engineers most dominantly. And this is, I don't know if you know about my web series that I was producing.
Yeah, I was just about to touch upon your series called Technically Single. You launched it at the end of 2018.
Yes.
Do you want to share what this series is all about?
So a few years back, I came to the conclusion that we have no engineering heroes in television shows and movies. The most famous engineer in a movie, nobody knows that he is an engineer. Or have you known that Old Shatterhand is an engineer? You know, Winnetou and Old Shatterhand. Yeah. Old Shatterhand is the engineer, but nobody knows it. And otherwise, we have engineers on movie shows like in Star Wars, it's Scotty, but he's only the hero of third kind, the third level hero. First level hero is certainly the Captain Kirk. And then the second level hero is Spock, and McCoy is also important because he's the doctor. Then comes the engineer, Scotty, and he has very limited text only and a very limited role to play in this show. And it is very, very typical for this one. And then I try to convince my former colleagues from media life in media, why don't you write a script for a movie or for a show with engineers? And then they usually said, you know what, this is so boring because engineers, what do they talk? Nobody understands what they're saying. And then they said, well, if Dr. House is giving a diagnosis of any kind, do you understand a single word? Does it matter? No, it does not matter. It's other things than the technical content that matters. So we have to tell stories with engineers in the front page. And the stories are all about the things that are important to us. It's about friendship. It's about love. It's about hate. It's about intrigues and all the good and bad things that happen to us in life. Grey's Anatomy is the main story, is also about relationships and friendships and all those things. And it happens to happen in a hospital. And this was, and I never could convince any media creation company or people to generate such a show. And then I said, damn it, I make it myself. And then I started to look around for young people who were willing to help me. So, and I bumped into people from the University for Film and Television here in Munich. And we kicked this around and said, cool, let's do it. And that's what we did. And it took us 5 years. But in the end, Technically Single was launched in 2018. And currently, as we speak, we're working on the scripts for the second season.
Okay, great. That's awesome. Now, all the listeners who are interested in your web series, they can watch it on Maxdome or 6.de. Am I right?
No longer, I'm afraid. The contracts have expired. But I hope that we'll be back online in the not too far future with the first season of Technically Single.
Okay, but then you have to tell us, when does the second season start? Do you already have a specific date in mind?
Yeah, it's difficult to say these days of Corona. Because, of course, creating scripts and preparing production is one thing, but you also have to have the opportunity to actually shoot that stuff, and that's kind of difficult these days. So it's hard to say. It won't happen this year anymore. It's maybe in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Professor Diepold, I'm super curious. Will the main characters and the storyline around Julia Mertlbauer and her best friend Jackie, both studying electrical engineering, stay, or will they change in the new season?
No. We hope we can continue, like in a good old series, that our main protagonist, Julia Mertlbauer, will be still part of the next season, and her friend Jackie, and they will, most of them will be around, and it will still be located in some technical university, which happens to look a little bit like Technical University of Munich. And they're still studying electrical engineering, and the story will continue. Yeah.
And did you already observe some effects of launching the first series?
Well, this is very difficult because, of course, if you had like a blockbuster movie, probably you could see something. We have not been able to measure it because the show was too small scale. We know from other investigations from the Gina Davis Institute in the United States as well as from Fraunhofer Institute, who did some studies in earlier, that television shows of this type have an impact. Like the X-Files was a very strong motivator for many women in the United States to pick up studies in natural sciences. And there the lady, the female character, is a scientist, and she's the rational person in a duo of investigators, and her partner, he's the more mystical guy, and she is very strict and very logical and very methodology approach. And she was basically inspiring a whole generation of young women to pick up physical studies. And that effect has been measured. The same with CIS shows or CSI, crime scene investigation, CSI. It also has been measured that after those shows were kicked off, that the number of students signing up for those study programs in the United States has been growing. There is an effect. Our show is maybe too small. Maybe the next one will become bigger. I don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. And for the next episode, will you also stick with this short video format? I think each episode currently lasts about 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah. So I guess that's for a web series. That's the kind of the format that we will be sticking with. Relatively short episodes, 10 minutes. Maybe it will be a few more depending on how much funding we can pick up. So we had in the first series, we only had 5 episodes, and we hope to maybe have 8 episodes next time, depending, as I said, how much money we can raise for this one.
And why did you decide to go for such a short video format? Was it mainly money-wise or due to the ever-growing demand for short-form video content?
I think that if you look into the typical behavior on the internet, how long things are to be watched on clips, It's certainly not 90 minutes or 50 minutes duration. It's a relatively short format, and 10 minutes we figured might be a good size for a video clips that you can engage the audience. And also generates kind of a very fast moving story. So it's it has its own language, you could say. And we have been, the script writer, Sebastian Stojetz, he has been winning a kind of prestigious award for his script for this show, and most people in this domain in the media business were quite intrigued by combining two things. One is this very short format, like 10 minutes for one episode, but not just having a production quality of like shooting your videos with a smart camera. But we used real movie production facilities and movie production quality process. So the visual quality and the production quality is very high. And still, in terms of the episode length, it's still a web format. That this is a different format than creating movies or television shows.
Talking about women and STEM, I mean, we finally have a female quota also for boardrooms of listed companies in Germany. Since you have been engaging to make the STEM field more attractive to diverse students for a couple of years, what is your take on the female quota?
Well, I'm not sure if I can call it a good idea. I think it's a necessary thing. We have been seeing throughout the years that if you leave it open for the companies and you appeal to their, let's say, their rationality to say, okay, you should do something about it. I said, yeah, we do, but we can't compromise quality, and we are only picking competent people, and we don't look out for the gender of those people. Well, we've been hearing this throughout those many years, and nothing really happens. And there's an experience also been made in countries like in Scandinavia, in Norway, where they have been starting with those quota regulations many years earlier. And the expectation there and the learnings is that you have to press for quota until you reach a level of about 30% women in the boardrooms. And once the women percentage is crossing the 30%, then I guess then you can release it. Then it creates its own momentum. But unless that you reach that point, I will still think you have to probably force those quota on those companies, and no excuses. But this does not only apply to women in the boardroom. If you look into the composition of the board of many big corporations like DAX companies, you can certainly ask the question, how diverse is the composition of those ones? I can remember seeing pictures of the board of a big German company, and there are 7 people on the picture, 1 woman, 6 men, and the men are all plus minus 2 years in age, all white, all the same background, all the same. So very homogeneous. Say, okay, how can you expect a board with such a composition for a big international corporation to face all the challenges that those companies are facing? So there's an old statement by Ashby. He was one of the, let's say, big figures in the times of cybernetics in the 1940s, 1950s. And Ashby said that an organism to interface with a complex environment has to be internally as complex as the outside the organism is supposed to be dealing with. So if you have a big corporation that is dealing with all the complexities in an international business, the internal structure needs to be just as complex, meaning diverse.
And I think it's really great that you stress that boardroom diversity goes beyond gender diversity. I mean, it covers age, background, ethnicity, experience, all that besides solely gender. But I think it's so striking that there are several studies that show that diversity in boardrooms has a positive effect on firm performance. Nevertheless, big corporations, have still such a hard time to commit to more diversity on the management level.
Well, we have the same argumentation within the universities as well. It's not just the big corporations, it's also the big universities.
And what measures does the TUM take to foster more diversity on its own management board?
Well, over the last years, also starting with the time when I was vice president responsible for those topics, the old president, he was pressing a lot of having, let's say, mechanisms in place to make sure that the chances for women to claim professorship is increased. So if you have to basically actively look for candidates, for female candidates in any subject. So if you are only receiving, let's say, 20 applications for a professorship or 30 and they're all male, you can't really continue. So you have to bring up and you have to headhunt for female professor candidates and make them, motivate them to apply. And then you have a certain ratio between female and male, and you have to continue to keep up this ratio through the whole process. And if you do not have a person, a female, on the list, on the short list, then you have to give particular reasons and explain why this is and why you have not been taking into account this candidate or that candidate, female candidate. So forcing people to actively think about it, that is certainly one way. More could be done, I'm quite sure about this, but it's a process. But we don't have quota, but a quota in a sense at least that we make sure that we within an appointment process, we stick to the cascade model. So that means if there's 30% women applying for the job, we expect 30% women on the shortlist. Last week, I looked into the TUM. We have this magazine that comes out every 2 months or month or so, TU-Mitteilungen, and there all the new professors are typically also introduced with a short CV and a short story and a picture. And opened up the booklet last month, and there was like 6 professors new joining the TUM. There were 5 women and 1 man. This is a rare moment. I have to keep this document.
Oh, great news. And I think this is a perfect example that shows that small changes in the recruitment process can actually make a big difference for diversity. So great that we can, close also this topic on such a positive note. Dan, Professor Diepold, thank you so much for sharing your experience and also your passion for the STEM field and taking action towards diversity in STEM. It was great having you here today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure for me.
And you're probably missing the answers to Professor Diepold's toolbox regarding his favorite book, thought leader, newsletter, and podcast. Unfortunately, we don't have the answers as an audio track since Professor Diepold was our very first podcast guest, our guinea pig, so to say. and we only developed the concept of the recurring toolbox afterwards. But we will share Professor Diepold's toolbox on our social media channels, especially on LinkedIn. So just search for Center for Digital Technology and Management or CDTM and subscribe to receive all the updates, toolboxes and news firsthand.
Thank you so much for listening. Stay healthy and we hope to have you back again on Wednesday in 2 weeks.